Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Israeli offensive on Gaza continues the fifth day, and volunteers being sent to defend a province in Iraq. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Israel's deadly offensive on the Gaza Strip enters its fifth day today. Several people were killed overnight, bringing the number to well over 100 Palestinians that have been killed since the offensive began Tuesday. The human rights representatives and coalition in the United Nations say the bombing cast doubt whether Israel is complying with international law, banning the targeting of civilians.
We have received deeply disturbing reports that many of the civilian casualties, including of children, occurred as a result of strikes on homes. Such reports raise doubts about whether the Israeli airstrikes have been in accordance with international humanitarian law and international human rights law. The targeting of civilian homes is a violation of IHL unless these homes are being used for military purposes.
Although Hamas and other militants have fired more than 600 rockets at Israel, so far no Israelis have been killed, in due large part to Israel's rocket defense system, a partly U.S.-funded Iron Dome. White House spokesman Josh Earnest condemned the rocket's attack on Israel from Lebanon, reaffirming Israel's right to defend itself, but also appealing for calm. Israel says it has targeted more than 1,000 sites.
The president also expressed his concern about the risk associated with further escalation and emphasized the need for all sides in this dispute to do everything they can to protect the lives of civilians and restore calm.
Israel says it has targeted 1,000 sites in Gaza, and more are intended. Palestinians say a mosque was bombed to the ground. Israel says the mosque was being used to hide weapons. The Iraqi government says it is sending 4,000 volunteers to bolster government control of Ramadi, the Anbar province capital. This move comes a day after Kurdish fighters captured several strategic oil fields near the Kurdish-controlled town of Kirkuk. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi government TV reported that the 4,000 volunteers were being airlifted to Ramadi from the country's mostly Shiite regions. A spokesman for Iraq's top Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, urged volunteers and regular army forces to respect the rights of Iraqi citizens in regions where they were fighting. He says he is calling on volunteers and soldiers who are defending their country to strictly respect the rights of all Iraqi citizens, no matter what their sectarian, ethnic, or political affiliations may be. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Afghanistan holding a second round of talks with President Hamid Karzai. He is there to defuse post-election violence and tensions amid allegations of voter fraud. The senior diplomat met Friday with frontrunner Ashraf Ghani as well as his rival Abdullah Abdullah. Today he met first with Abdullah, then talked with Ghani. Kerry is there attempting to end the political crisis that has cropped up just months before international troops are scheduled to leave the country.
The results that were announced on Monday are preliminary. They are neither authoritative nor final. And no one should be stating a victory at this point in time.
Mr. Kerry's visit does appear to have succeeded in getting the candidates to pull back from declarations of victory and threats to set up rival governments. The European Union is placing sanctions on 11 leaders of pro-Russian rebellions and the like in eastern Ukraine, including separatist leader Alexander Borodai. The rebels have declared independence for the region and have been fighting Ukrainian government troops. Borodai is a Russian citizen who has declared himself the prime minister of Donetsk region in the east of Ukraine. The EU had already imposed sanctions on many other people and businesses involved in the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Meanwhile, emergency officials in Donetsk say at least 4 civilians were killed by artillery fire that damaged several apartment buildings and in an overnight attack. In Russia, the president there has begun a six-day tour of Latin American countries. Vladimir Putin's first stop on Friday was Cuba, where he met with Cuban President Raul Castro. He's scheduled to be in Rio de Janeiro tomorrow for the World Cup final. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, July 12th. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
This has been threatened lately, at least in two countries, in Nigeria and in Uganda, related to the obligation of anybody to report.
Criminalizing homosexual and transgender behavior may be hampering these people from getting the health services they need.
The part that the World Bank's project supports focuses on improving the deployment of teachers more equitably across and within districts, motivating teachers to spend more time in teaching.
The World Bank grants over $100 million in credit to Tanzania for the education of primary and secondary school children.
The problem emanates from our politics. Our government, particularly the head of state and government, commander-in-chief and all the titles we have, is a short-term person who wants to please school there and then.
And a Zimbabwean presidential candidate blames the country's ongoing economic crisis on President Robert Mugabe and his government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
The World Health Organization says discrimination, stigmatization, and laws that criminalize homosexual and transgender behavior are hampering these people from getting the health services they need. And as Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, the World Health Organization is warning HIV/AIDS will spread if gays and other people at high risk fail to get access to HIV prevention and treatment.
Antiretroviral therapy is successfully keeping millions of people with HIV alive, yet millions of people who are most at risk of infection are not receiving these life-saving drugs or other essential care. The World Health Organization says men who have sex with men, people in prison, people who inject drugs, sex workers, and transgender people are facing discriminatory laws and policies in many countries which are preventing them from gaining access to HIV prevention, testing, and treatment services. WHO says stigmatization and laws criminalizing so-called deviant behavior discourages high-risk people from seeking help and are driving the disease underground. WHO HIV Department Director Gottfried Hirnschau says these policies are counterproductive and threaten to spread the epidemic in the broader community.
Obviously, these people, men who have sex with men, injecting drugs, they don't live in isolation. And we see overlap of these behaviors. Somebody who uses drugs can be an MSM, can sell sex. Somebody who is a sex worker will have partners, may have children, etc. So obviously, there's these linkages that are very important.
By the end of 2013, WHO reports around 13 million people were receiving antiretroviral therapy. Most of these people are living in poor and middle-income countries. This has led to a 20% drop in HIV-related deaths. While this is good news, the WHO says preventive efforts are still lagging behind, particularly among the high-risk groups. UNAIDS Rights, Gender Prevention and Community Mobilization Director Mariangela Simao says many people do not seek treatment for HIV because they fear their right to confidentiality will be breached.
This has been threatened lately, at least in two countries, in Nigeria and in Uganda, related to the obligation of anybody to report if they know of someone who's a gay man or a lesbian. We have reports from these countries that have documented serious disruptions in the availability and access to HIV and other health services following the promulgation of these laws.
The World Health Organization is launching new guidelines on HIV prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and care, focusing on these five key high-risk groups in advance of next week's AIDS conference in Melbourne, Australia. The guidelines include a range of clinical recommendations and stress the need for countries to remove the legal and social barriers that are preventing many people from accessing life-saving services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In another engagement, the World Health Organization warned Thursday that 38 million people die each year from chronic diseases, which are preventable and treatable. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
A new report from the WHO warns that nearly half of those who die from non-communicable diseases, around 16 million people, do so prematurely, before the age of 70. The majority of people who die from these illnesses reside in developing countries. WHO says deaths from non-communicable illnesses such as heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and chronic lung disease have increased worldwide since 2000 and grown the most in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific. But by 2020, the largest increases in these deaths will occur in Africa. Progress in reversing the trends has been insufficient and uneven. WHO Director General Margaret Chan told a UN meeting Thursday that the childhood obesity epidemic is an early warning sign of bigger problems ahead.
An abundance of overweight children readily progresses to an abundance of chronically ill adults, and a financial burden on the health systems that can be unbearable, even in the richest countries in the world.
She said a decline in childhood obesity would be an indication that some of the major risk factors for these diseases are being attacked at their core. The report, which breaks down the data on a country-by-country basis, notes that governments are aware of the problem of chronic illnesses, and at least half of them have a plan and funding to address them. More countries are also monitoring some of the main risk factors that bring on these illnesses, such as alcohol consumption, tobacco use, an unhealthy diet, and a lack of exercise. More than half of the world's governments have signed up to a WHO Global Action Plan to reduce premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by a quarter by 2025. Dr. Chan said prevention, early diagnosis, and treatment are important tools in reaching this goal.
Early diagnosis, early treatment can be secondary prevention to prevent heart attack, to prevent kidney failure, blindness from diabetes, and to prevent, you know, amputation.
She said WHO is working to make sure that people not only have a long life expectancy, but a healthy one. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
France celebrates Bastille Day Monday, July 14th by marking another historic event, the upcoming centenary of World War I. Countries who fought in the 1914 to 1918 conflict will participate at the Bastille Day parade in Paris. But from the French capital, Lisa Brandt reports for VOA that the presence of Algerian forces is exposing long-standing tensions between France and Algeria.
The presence of foreign fighters is nothing new at France's Bastille Day parades. Last year, African forces participating in the operation against Islamist rebels in Mali marched down the Champs-Élysées. This year, the spotlight is on another conflict, World War I, which began 100 years ago. French President François Hollande has invited dozens of nations whose soldiers died in the battlefields of the Great War to join the July 14th event. That includes France's former colony, Algeria. Three Algerian military officials will participate in the events. France's government is downplaying their presence. But the announcement has sparked strong reactions both in France and Algeria, laying bare old and unhealed wounds. A century ago, Algeria was not an independent country, but a colony of France. It achieved its independence half a century later, only after a long and bloody conflict. In Algeria, critics denounced their country's participation in Bastille Day, claiming many Algerians were forcibly conscripted during World War I. And many critics on both sides of the Mediterranean note that many differences between the two nations have never fully been examined or resolved. In France, the far-right National Front launched a campaign to protest Algeria's participation. The party argues Algiers has failed to resolve sensitive issues like the expulsion of French citizens after Algeria's independence.
Monsieur, ils étaient français. Par conséquent, les soldats algériens n'ont strictement rien à faire sur les Champs-Élysées.
Speaking on French TV this week, National Front leader Marine Le Pen said the Algerians fighting in World War I were actually French citizens at the time. She says they have no right to be present at the parade, particularly since today the Algerian government does nothing but insult France. But others support Algeria's Bastille Day participation. They include French citizen Alain Ferqui, who heads an association of children of so-called Harkis, the name for Algerians who fought on France's side. Ferqui's father arrived in France as a young man. He was among the many African forces fighting alongside France during the Second World War.
Le débarquement de l'Afrique, de l'armée d'Afrique, qui était composée de Marocains, de
Tunisiens. Ferqui recounts how these African forces, Moroccans, Tunisians, and Algerians, landed on the southern French coast. They helped liberate the Provence region and the French island of Corsica from Nazi occupation. He says the presence of these African soldiers, both during the Great War and World War II, has not been sufficiently appreciated.
Il faut tourner la page et arriver à quelque chose de serein.
Ferqui believes France and Algeria must turn the page on a bitter past. He says it's the future of both countries to strengthen economic, cultural, and political ties. And he hopes Algeria's presence during Bastille Day Monday will be a step in that direction. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The World Bank's International Development Association has approved a $122 million credit for the education of primary and secondary school children in Tanzania through the Big Results Now in Education program. While speaking with me from her office in Washington, D.C., the World Bank's Education Practice Manager for Eastern and Southern Africa, Sajida Bashir, stated that the Big Results Now in Education program focuses on improving the quality of education in Tanzania's primary and secondary schools. Sajida Bashir also explains the role of the World Bank in the Big Results Now in Education program.
Essentially, the part that the World Bank's project supports focuses on improving the deployment of teachers more equitably across and within districts, motivating teachers to spend more time in teaching, helping them to improve their own knowledge of both the subject matter and of pedagogy, getting the capitation grants to schools on time so that schools can have their learning materials available for students, focusing on the teaching of reading, writing, and basic mathematics by the end of grade 2 and improving student achievement on that, and gathering data and monitoring results much more effectively.
Is this going to be an ongoing program, or is there a time frame within which it should be accomplished?
The government program is actually for 4 years, and our project also supports the program for 4 years, but obviously, the effort to improve quality has to go on beyond these 4 years. But the government and the bank and other development partners agreed that what was required was a very big push to achieve results which are visible and palpable in a reasonably short time period. There are evaluations at different levels. For instance, at the student level, you know, there will be assessments of student learning in reading, writing, and basic mathematics, especially at the end of grade 2. Then there would be third-party verification of certain results to be achieved at the school level in terms of, for instance, you know, number of teachers that are trained or teacher availability in schools in terms of capitation grants arriving in schools. The key feature of the bank's project is that its disbursements of the credit are actually linked to achievement of certain results on the ground. And those results are already predetermined and agreed with the government and other stakeholders. They're part of the agreement of the credit. And they would be dispersed at specific times depending on the achievement of those results. The verification of those results is going to be done by a third party.
What grade level students are being targeted for access to the program?
It targets basically primary education, but a lot of the focus is on lower primary education because we know that we need to get children to actually learn the basics of reading and writing by grade two. If children don't learn that, then they're not able to make further progress in school. So this is why of the six sets of results that are linked to the disbursement of funds, two are related to distributing teachers more equitably across Tanzania and strengthening student achievement in reading, writing, and basic mathematics by the end of grade two.
The World Bank Country Director for Tanzania stated that education can be absolutely transformational if every child can acquire the kind of learning that can open new doors to a brighter future. How will this transformation help contribute to Tanzania's economic improvement?
In modern economies, one of the key ingredients for success is the quality of the people. You know, the skills they have, the health they have, their ability to work, their ability to be creative, and so on. We know that education is one of the key factors that helps to improve the skills and knowledge of the workforce. Tanzania's population is expanding. That's one of its main resources. It's its young population. But it also has resources in oil and gas, in agriculture, its land, its tourism sector, and so on. But if these sectors are to become more high value added, if they're going to become more productive for the people who are working in them, one of the factors is indeed the education of levels and the skill levels of the people.
The World Bank's Education Practice Manager for Eastern and Southern Africa, Sajida Bashir. She spoke with me from her office in Washington, D.C.
Former Zimbabwean Finance Minister and presidential candidate Simba Makoni has pinned the country's ongoing economic crisis on President Robert Mugabe and his government. The leader of the opposition party, Mavambo Kosile Don, who contested in the country's 2008 presidential elections, has also championed the coming together of opposition parties to form a strong opposition against the ruling ZANU-PF party. In an interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service, Makoni says President Mugabe has failed to make critical decisions on issues that affect the country.
The Minister of Finance budget statement analyzed correctly the difficulties in our economy. Its consistency and reliability and credibility of government policies and their implementation. Throughout the history of our independence, government produces economic policies which they don't implement. So I would say that what needs to be done in the Zimbabwe economy is implementation consistently, persistently, and sustainably. But policies that government promulgates are not just slogans for the time being, and that policies are not scattered and abandoned in midstream. But investors, whether they are local investors, and there are many Zimbabweans who would like to invest in their country, we have no confidence that their investment is secure. Or even if they are foreign, their concerns are exactly the same.
You were in government yourself for a number of years. Where exactly does the problem emanate from when it comes to the implementation matrix?
The problem emanates from our politics. Our government, particularly the head of state and government and commander-in-chief and all those titles he has, is a short-term person who wants to please people there and then. He has no staying power for difficult policies. So he then requires those who work under him to behave like he wants immediate gratification.
But but those who support Mr. Mugabe will say sanctions negatively impacted on Zimbabwe's economy.
There are no sanctions, Blessing. You know that. Mugabe knows that. Everybody knows that. But even if there were, Blessing, Zimbabwe would not have been the first country to be under sanctions. Rhodesia grew under mandatory economic sanctions. Iraq was under economic sanctions. Iran is currently under economic sanctions. But their economies are not dwindling and declining like ours is. So Mugabe and his team have always been keen on passing the blame and scapegoat. It's time we accepted that we are our own liberators and that responsibility for our growth and development lies with us, not with other people. Other people can help us, indeed may help us, but primarily we can't bank our faith on other people when we ourselves are doing nothing.
Some are also saying the reason why ZANU-PF behaves the way it is behaving is because the opposition is very weak, and as a result, it is giving Mr. Mugabe a blank check.
Well, there is no doubt that the opposition is weak, but that's no excuse, because Mugabe went to the electorate to seek a mandate to serve the people, not to serve the opposition. So it is a nonsense to make an argument like that.
Dr. Makoni, there's also this talk of a grand coalition. Are you in it?
I want to reaffirm what I said before. In January 2012, I called formally for a grand coalition for change. And I'm not claiming special credit for it, but I'm saying I'm one of those who has advocated that all Zimbabwean leaders, leaders in politics, leaders in business, leaders in the profession, leaders in civil society, and other categories of leadership need to work together to solve the problems that our people are confronting on a daily basis. So the answer to the first part of your question is yes, I am for it. Am I in it? No, I'm not in it because a grand coalition doesn't exist yet.
That was opposition party leader and former Zimbabwean finance minister, Simba Makoni. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service.
The Israeli Air Force struck targets inside Gaza for the fifth day Saturday as rockets fired from the Palestinian territory set off alarms across southern Israel. VOA's Gabe Justler reports a mosque allegedly used by militants was among targets hit by Israel.
Officials in Gaza say about 120 people have been killed in Israeli military strikes since operations began in response to weeks of Palestinian rocket fire into Israel. A mosque in central Gaza was among the targets struck Saturday. Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson, Lieutenant Libby Weiss, says the building was being used by Hamas militants.
It's important to note that this was a mosque that was used almost entirely for Hamas operations, meaning as a structure, perhaps, yes, it was a mosque, but it was very clear that it was being used, and I would say almost hijacked by Hamas for terror purposes.
The United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Office has said the majority of Palestinians killed in Israeli strikes since operations began have been civilians. Several Israeli citizens have been wounded by Palestinian rockets, which are being launched at longer range than in previous conflicts. Israeli Defense Forces credit their Iron Dome missile defense system, which intercepts rockets in mid-air, with preventing greater casualties. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Friday, Israel is considering all military options despite international calls for a ceasefire. Britain, France, and Turkey have expressed concerns about the loss of life in Gaza. U.S. President Barack Obama says the U.S. is willing to help facilitate a cessation of hostilities while backing Israel's right to defend itself. Dr. Mahdi Abdulhadi, head of a Palestinian academic society in Jerusalem, says both Israeli and Palestinian leadership have shown little willingness to back down.
Netanyahu refused any reconciliation, any negotiation, any halting of the operation, and he's carrying on the mission as usual. The same thing Hamas is saying, let's go forward as it planned, whatever happened will happen to all of us.
Israel claims to have hit more than 1,100 targets inside Gaza since operations began. The military has called up more than 30,000 reservists and is now weighing whether to begin ground operations in Gaza. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
This girl is beautiful. She's beautiful.
It's now time for our Saturday music spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Galine vanna nyumirwa mubuze ke mirembe kali wadenze mubita na yari na ye mikwano asana yo spesis simulunda simutaiza sive manya kazanyo era olibwambuza Lwachi mufanto Muta munti Katika richi mwecho Karichi Oangewe mwakala mungeriwe mirembe Tapukani Katika richi mama Karichi Mungo mwakala mungeriwe mirembe Tapukani Simulingiriza muwakabanga Kale wadolu mumbuza Unayebwa sirika Sikaka ansa Esimuwe imba Simu soya soya Zesiri loya Hera Oni wambuza Lwache mufanto Muda mundi Katika richi mwecho Karichi Karichi Wangewe mwagala mungeriewe mirembe Tapukani Katika richi mwecho Karichi Mundo kwa mwagala mungeriewe mirembe Tapukani
Patron,
Mais si je dis non à la femme, elle va se venger. Que faut-il dire? Oh, que faut-il dire? Que tout bouillait. Si je dis oui, j'ai peur du patron. Kabakouye. Mais si je dis non, la femme va se venger. Que tout bouillait. Ah, quelle affaire! Ah, quelle histoire! Que faut-il faire? Que faut-il dire? Si je dis oui, si je dis non. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire! Que mais si je dis non, la femme va se venger. Koutoubouye. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire! Que faut-il dire? Que faut-il faire? Si je dis oui, si je dis non. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire!
Hey yo, di mabula ne. Hey yo,
That was our Saturday Music Sport, and I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music from across the continent. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Yang.
It's always a pleasure for me to share my views about America's relations with Africa on the Voice of America. Every week, as I look around the world, I see a number of developments affecting human beings around the planet. But I pay particular attention to how these events relate to America's relations with Africa. This week, I intend to look at how President Obama's presidency relates to America's relations with Africa. There are three points to be addressed at this juncture. President Barack Hussein Obama, Africa, and the future of development in the continent. In the next couple of minutes, I'm going to be looking at this problem. I want to identify some of the forces and factors I find relevant in understanding the Obama presidency and American policy in Africa. When President Barack Obama assumed the presidency in 2008, the Western European countries had already left Africa as colonial powers, beginning with the independence of Ghana in 57, and then the independence of Nigeria. Ethiopia, Liberia were all the independent countries. When Kwame Nkrumah invited them at the first conference of African heads of states, only Liberia and Ethiopia were independent countries. They were the only African countries represented at the UN, except for Haiti. There were no other black countries. Well, there were only three blacks, Haiti, Liberia, and Ethiopia at the founding of the United Nations. When you look at the Obama presidency, you have to go back in time and see how his presidency brings into focus the role and place of African people in world history. It just happened by chance that when Barack Obama became the president of the United States in 2008, much of the story deals with American society. But in the background, you have celebrations of African achievement among African Americans, continental Africans, Afro-Latinos, the people from the Caribbean as well. So when we talk about President Obama, Africa, and the future of development in Africa, we go back to 1619. In 1619, America was at a very interesting period of its development. A number of Englishmen came to Jamestown in Virginia and started a new process for the English-speaking people. Soon after, you will find in 1619, a number of black people, according to Randall Robinson, those 25 Africans who landed in Jamestown came from Angola. And this is a very important narrative to tell, because what happened is from 1619 to 2008, President Barack Obama would become the first black president of the United States from 1619 to 1776. That was a long period of English colonial rule of America. And the founding fathers who came out of Virginia and New England will join the narrative. They came before Columbus story told by Ivan Vansatima, who is now deceased, from Rutgers University, is part of the story of Barack Obama coming here. Second story is 1619 to the Civil War. You have another part of the African-American story. Leonard Robinson talks about how those people came from Angola, and he traces his route back to that group. And then another African-American writer who adds to our understanding of American policy with Africa was the editor of Ebony magazine. He wrote a book called They Came Before the Mayflower, talking about those blacks who came to Virginia in 1619. Truth be told, those who look at American relations with Africa can see historically from 1619 to 1776, when America came into being, you have a colonial America. Then from the end of colonial America with republicanism, democracy, attempt at democracy among the American people, you move from 1776 to 1865 with Lincoln. This is a very important period because from 1619 to the end of the slave trade, that's a story of Africa, America, and the English-speaking people. And President Barack Obama would be a beneficiary of this narrative, the story of people of Africa on the continent, the Middle Passage and slavery, and the establishment of the abolitionist movement in England, and the rise of the end of slavery in America. The Barack Obama story cannot be complete unless one goes back to 1619, to 1865 with Lincoln. With Lincoln, you can see how the narrative of the founding fathers, beginning with George Washington as the first president of the United States, as number one, and Barack Obama will become the 44th president. So there is a long interlude from George Washington to Barack Obama. So if you're an African who looks at American history, you look at African history and you try to understand the legacies of Barack Obama, whether one likes it or not, truth be told, Barack Obama is the 44th president of the United States. White Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, African Americans, and all those from overseas must recognize that from 1619 to 1865, there's a long history of slavery in America, and that's the way it is today.
That was Dr. Nyang with that commentary.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The celebrations were muted July 9th as South Sudan celebrated its third anniversary of independence. 3 years ago, after decades of civil war, the South Sudanese people voted to split away from the North. And, amid high hopes and much jubilation, the world's newest nation was born on July 9th, 2011. The cheer has turned to gloom in many parts of the East African nation as political infighting erupted in December. The conflict, now in its seventh month, has cost thousands of lives and displaced over 1 million people. Despite repeated attempts to bring the parties to the bargaining table to negotiate a transitional government and end the crisis, foot-dragging by both the government of South Sudan and the rebel faction headed by former Vice President Riek Machar continue to undermine the process led by the Regional Bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. Too much blood has been spilled and too many lives lost to allow South Sudan's moment of hope and opportunity to slip from its grasp. With the memories of July 9th, 2011 fresh in mind, now is the time to honor fully the cessation of hostilities agreement of January 23rd to end the violence, especially which targets civilians. The people of South Sudan need their leaders to use the IGAD peace process to end the conflict and establish a transitional government that can ensure stability, prosperity, and peace for all. Now is the time for the nation's leaders to show courage and leadership and to reaffirm their commitment to unity, to reconciliation and accountability, and to a better future for the people of South Sudan. The United States, which has stood with the people of South Sudan throughout its troubled path to independence, remains committed to continue supporting them during its current crisis, as well as to lead the international response to the looming humanitarian and refugee crisis there. We remain a steadfast partner in support of their efforts to achieve a more peaceful and prosperous future for their young nation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.